Well, hello everybody, and welcome to Cooking in Real Time, second episode of the special quarantine edition. My name is Zora O'Neill, and some business first because I'm super out of practice with this, and I realized I just didn't do it in the first episode, but there's a website, cookinginrealtime.com, and I put all the recipes and a little shopping list, or in our case now a not shopping list, stuff you can scrounge around for and maybe substitute and things like that. I put all that stuff on the website for each episode, so if you're an impatient person, like me sometimes, you can go there and check on it. And just cook the recipe if you want to, and you can skim through the podcast, or you can read the whole recipe and feel super prepared and then listen along, however you want to do it. The goal here is just to cook yourself a nice dinner and maybe enjoy the process and maybe get better as you go, but no pressure. I know we're all feeling like we should be improving ourselves with this great gift of time we accidentally have, if we're lucky enough to have that. But, you know, we're just getting through day by day, and I'll be honest, minutes ago I was sitting on the sofa thinking, oh, I don't really want to do this. Oh, maybe I'll just take a little nap. But my whole adult life has largely revolved around telling people that they'll feel better if they cook themselves dinner, or if they cook for themselves at all, it will improve your life immensely. So I figured better just follow my own damn advice. And so I am up off the sofa and I am recording, and I'm just double checking, yes, that I'm still recording. And as usual here at the beginning of things, I'm kind of pacing around the kitchen and I'm cleaning things just because it is nice to start with the decks cleared. So I'm wiping off some countertops. I don't know about you, but I find it really hard to concentrate when there's clutter around. So if you are like that, then it definitely pays to spend just a few minutes before you start any kitchen project just putting things away as in the places they belong, as much as you possibly can, because later when you're feeling a little pressure perhaps and need to make a split-second decision or reach for something, you will have the mental capacity to do it instead of being like, why can't I see the knife I'm looking for in the middle of this mess? So that's what I'm doing right now. I can't believe how many crumbs are in this kitchen. The one side effect of constant bread baking is lots and lots of crumbs. Anyway, I'm not complaining. We've had excellent bread. So tonight, what are we doing tonight? Tonight I have a measly little half pound of ground beef that needs using, so I'm going to get that out. And what I'm going to do with that, I have a half a pound of ground beef and a small ache in my heart for the Southwest Airlines In-Flight magazine, which folded just a few days ago. A very sad side effect of this whole thing is they just decided to stop publishing and lay everybody off. And I didn't read it a lot because I didn't read, or I didn't fly Southwest a whole lot, but weirdly, I have had a recipe from the Southwest Airlines In-Flight magazine for probably 20 years. It's a recipe that is called Midnight Meat Sauce for Spaghetti, and I mean, everybody's like, oh, where should I find good recipes? Honestly, they're everywhere. The world, there is no shortage of recipes. And even the Southwest Airlines In-Flight magazine can be an amazing source. As I vaguely recall, more than 20 years ago, I think I got this recipe. As I vaguely recall, it was an interview with some chef, and it was, this was one of his things where he was like, this is what I cook for myself quick when I come home from work. And, yeah, like I said, midnight meat sauce for spaghetti. And what it is, essentially, is a really quickie bolognese, like just, you know, a tomato-ish meat sauce, but fundamentally a meat sauce. Why I say it's fundamentally a bolognese is because it relies on soaking the beef in a bit of milk. And the reason you do that is to, the lactic acid in the milk helps soften up the meat and like cuts down. Oh my God. Why am I even pretending to be scientific? It just makes the meat softer. That's all you need to know. So like normally when you would pan fry, ground beef, you end up with these like mid-sized crumbles. But after you've soaked meat in milk, you can get it down to these much finer crumbles, and it just makes the whole thing just a little more velvety and nice. So the first, usually when I make pasta, any kind of pasta, no matter what it is, in terms of timing, usually the first thing I do is put on a pot of water to boil. Tonight, what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to put the meat in the milk right away and get that kind of working its magic, because we kind of want that to happen for, I don't know, maybe half an hour. For some reason, I just thought I was too good to also save the instructions to the recipe. I clipped out the ingredients list, but I didn't save the instructions. And it's been a long time since I've cooked this. It's like pasted into a little scrapbook I've had since I moved to New York City. And there it sits. It says, this is for a single portion. It says 4 ounces of ground beef. I've got 1/2 pound. So I'm just going to put that in a bowl. And then all right, so that's that, and a cup, 4 ounces of meat to a cup of milk. Fortunately, we just went shopping and got some milk. Since I'm doubling, there would be 2 cups. Let's talk about substitutions. Of course. I think basically any ground meat, this would be fine with and interesting with. I don't think you can substitute other kinds of milk aside from dairy milk, because other kinds of milk are not going to have that lactic acid. So this is unfortunately very strictly a dairy milk treatment. But in terms of any other meat, pork would, I mean, everything's going to taste different, of course, but it'll probably taste good. So I think it would be fine to sub in basically any other kind of ground meat you would have. Even Chrissy was asking me about ground turkey. Marla was asking about ground turkey. I think ground turkey would probably be great with this. You might want to amp up some of the other stuff we're going to put in just a little bit, because turkey isn't bursting with flavor. But you could definitely sub that in. So basically the overview is I put the meat in the milk, and I'm just going to take a fork here, and it really looks like the most disgusting bowl of breakfast cereal right now. I'm just taking a fork and sort of breaking it into smaller chunks so more of the meat surface area is exposed to the milk. And I gotta say, I feel bad every time I say meat and milk. I realize this is like the most unkosher friendly thing you could do. And it's really a hostile thing to do to anybody because the combination of raw beef and milk in a bowl, just, it looks disgusting. Right now, you're very glad I'm not doing a video. I'm just sort of forking this in pieces because it looks like, oh, there's like a family story of me when I was, I don't know, 2 or something, and I threw up all over the living room, and my mom was horrified because I vomited like this like fluffy pink stuff, and my mother's first thought was that I was like throwing up my stomach lining or something. Like it looked like some part of my body that I had just expelled. Turned out it was only the rug pad, like the little pad underneath our carpet, that I had somehow pulled out and stuck in my mouth. So when I see something that's like this weird lumpy pink color, I always think of the story. And now you can too. How lucky for you. sorry about that. So that's all doing its thing. I'm averting my eyes from the weird, gross, pink slurry over there. And there's one more thing that I needed to clean and should have before this whole thing started. Just wiping out one of our cast iron skillets. Okay. So, all right, that's happening. Now I'll definitely put some water on to boil. No, there. So when I was growing up in the 80s, I feel like that was when people suddenly were like, oh, we've learned the way to make pasta. And there was so much, like I remember when my parents, you know, got the tip that maybe you're supposed to toss the pasta with olive oil right after boiling it and all this stuff. There were all these tips going around. And one of the big tips is always like a huge pot of water. And when I grew up in New Mexico, which is high elevation, which means it takes like 4 hours for anything to boil. So boiling stuff for pasta was like a massive chore. And maybe that's why I deep down in my heart of hearts, I'm like, whatever you do, put the pasta water on first. Oh my God. Over the years, I have learned, actually, that you can get by with a lot less pasta water. I'm sure there are still super purists out there. But if you're doing kind of smaller pasta that doesn't have to get pushed down under this, I'm not explaining it well, but you know, if you have a small pot of water and you're trying to put a long stick of spaghetti in it, that's difficult and takes a little work. But if you have like farfalle or something and you just dump it in, you don't need a ton of water. And actually, you know, it's fine if the water gets really starchy and stuff, because in the end, that starchiness is beneficial to the sauce, usually. So I don't know where we got this idea in the 80s that you were supposed to like rinse the pasta and then toss it with olive oil. Maybe it's for certain kinds of sauces. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm putting in lots and lots of salt. That is one thing. One sort of 80s rule that seems wise. Lots and lots of salt. Because you don't want the pasta to be relatively unsalted. And then your sauce has to be extra, extra salty to make up for the blend. You'll be like tasting your sauce and you'll be like, ah, perfect. And then you add it to unsalted pasta and you're like, it's kind of bland. Conversely, if you know you're going to make a sauce that has some really salty components, then you can kind of ease off the salt in the pasta water just to give yourself a little wiggle room. Okay, so put some water on the back burner there in a big pot because I am going to be making spaghetti, so I want to give myself some room to stick that spaghetti in under the surface. And I guess I should explain to you a little bit more about what really goes into this midnight meat sauce. So like I said, it's the ground meat and the milk, which are sitting and turning a terrible shade of pink. It's olive oil and garlic and anchovy, our special ingredient friend. When in doubt, add anchovies. And this is where I should have looked in the fridge first to see if we have anchovies. This whole thing could be doomed. Okay. There's the tomato paste that I opened the other night. That's good. I remember reading somewhere I might have even just mentioned it the last episode, but I've been burned by it so many times. Like, if you have not put your hands on it right before you're going to cook, it might not exist. Like, the head count you do in the morning when you're like, oh yeah, maybe I'll cook whatever for dinner tonight. Many things can happen over the course of the day. So you really you should do what I didn't do, and you should check and make sure you have stuff before you start cooking. All right, I did find the anchovies. I also found a random empty plastic bag. Throwing that away, that's what makes the crinkly noise. All right, the anchovies we have are a little bit of a pain in the ass. They're the salt-packed ones. So they need rinsing and kind of fiddling. What does that say? One anchovy fillet? All right. So I'm going to do two of these salt-packed ones. You rinse the great thing about anchovies, period, is no matter how you get them, they'll just last in your fridge forever. We have these salt-packed ones because we can get them really easily, and they're very good. And then I often have a tube of anchovy paste, which is sort of my quick and dirty if I just want, like, a quick blitz of flavor and something of salty flavor in something I'm cooking. I'll squeeze in some anchovy paste. But the salt-packed anchovies are, like, good enough to put in, like, salad dressing and raw things. But the pain with them is you have to fillet them, which is a very fiddly thing to do. But, you know, anchovies are accommodating little creatures. They actually come apart really easily. So I had rinsed the salt off these guys, and then I just took a small paring knife. And if you just poke it in along the backbone, you can just cut away the top part from the bones. I'm going to put that in a different little bowl there. And then once you get one side, then you can grab its poor little spine and pull that off. And then you've got your other thing, and then you end up with stuff that looks remarkably like the little anchovy fillets you see when you open up a can. And there they are. So that's one. I'm going to do two, because whatever, I like anchovies. Technically, the recipe says one anchovy fillet, so if I'm doubling the recipe, I would really just be using one whole anchovy, but I figure my anchovy butchering skills are not that awesome, so to make up for losing some of the meat, some of the fish flesh, what do you call that? It's not flesh. What is fish? Fish is fish. Anyway, here we go now. Here we go. All right. Oh, nothing like tearing a little critter limb from limb, even if it doesn't have limbs, I feel better already. I'm glad I'm not sitting on the sofa taking a nap. The kitchen magic is working already. Okay, we've got got our little anchovies. Notice I did not chop them up because you don't have to. Once again, anchovies, so accommodating. They just melt in the pan. It's like they want to be eaten. All right, and I'm gonna peel some garlic. What do they say? One large garlic clove. Oh, please. We'll do more than that. Why do one when you could do two? And then since we're doubling it, we'll do four. All right. I've got two large garlic cloves and two kind of smaller ones, wimpy ones. And then I'm going to peel a fifth one because we're going to make a little salad dressing. I haven't talked about the whole rest of the menu. There really is not a whole rest of the menu. There's just a little side salad. But that's fine. It will still feel like a meal when we're done. So I'm just peeling these little garlics. So I don't know what you do, but what I do is I take the knife and I just slice off the very top kind of cruddy end, you know, the part that was connected to the base of the clove, and that often will loosen up the whole peel. You can do like I did last time. I was smashing the cloves a lot more. I had fresher garlic a week ago, and it needed a little more manhandling to get the peel off. Now my poor garlic is a week older, and it's a little more withered up, so the peels are slipping off pretty easily, and I don't need to bash them. So, of course, as I said last week, if you bash them enough, then they're kind of all broken up, and it makes them easy to chop them into small pieces. So I'm just going to mince these guys. The big cloves I just slice several slices lengthwise, and then I hold the whole clove still together and turn it and then chop crossways. Doesn't have to be precise at all. If you get down to like the last third of the clove, it's all wobbly, that's fine. Chop, chop, chop. As I said, irregular chopping is the great luxury of the home cook, and you should indulge in it at all times. Sloppy is good. All right. There's a visitor in the kitchen who's checking my levels. Hey. My producer is here. All right. It's all good. I've chopped up four cloves of garlic. Duh. Part of them are flying off the cutting board. Oh, the producer is stealing pieces. Watch the knife, mister. Hey. I set aside one of the cloves I peeled because we're going to make some salad dressing. And that one's whole because I want to run that through a garlic press. If you don't have a garlic press, go ahead and chop up all the garlic together and set aside like a clove-ish for the salad dressing. But if you do have a garlic press, or if you have the patience to like mash garlic with salt, that's even more delicious, then you can leave that clove whole for later. But right now, I'm going to put all this garlic I just chopped up, whoops, in its own little bowl. So my kitchen layout is such that my cutting board is fairly far from the stove, which means the little bowls come in very handy. I can't just turn around and fling things into a pan. So it also helps me keep the cutting board clean and makes it easier to concentrate when the cutting board is clean. So, all right. Every last scrap of garlic. Don't let it go to waste. Okay, got our anchovies and our garlic. They're ready to go. Now, if I were the fancy chef, whoever he was, it would be so nice if through this process of me cooking this recipe, this guy from like 22 years ago found out that I was using his recipe and I found out who the heck he was. I have no memory, and that's not something that's online. But whoever he was a professional, and he probably would have made the whole damn sauce by now. But I've just been dawdling and talking, so we're moving very slowly. I have the tomato paste, I have salt, and spaghetti. Okay, so we are ready to cook. And the meat has been sitting here in its milk turning super goopy. I'm gonna put that by the stove. God, it really looks like some kind of, it's like frozen strawberries and Cool Whip or something. It's so pink. It's weird. I'm just going to put all that stuff by the stove for now. And it all comes together really quickly. And we're just going to cook it in the time it takes the pasta to boil. So what we're going to do right now before we actually start cooking anything is we'll make a little salad. And that's what makes a dinner. So I know I've said this in older episodes from way back, but I was raised with a very strict idea of what constituted a meal. And in our house, you always had to have salad, which always struck me when I was a kid. It struck me as crazy because we'd literally be having vegetable soup for dinner and a salad. And I was like, what is the point? There are vegetables in the soup. But of course now I'm grown up and I do the exact same thing and it makes total sense to me because you want rustling. I'm pulling things. I'm trying to decide. I have dill and I have cilantro. What do I want in the salad? I think I'll put the dill. You can do this salad without herbs at all. But I happen to have some and I don't want them to go to waste. So I'm just going to make, I think my mother used to call this a crunch salad. It's hard things. It's carrots and celery. And then I think we'll toast some almonds. So it's three ways of crunching and some herbs if you have them, if you want them. When I was a kid, I don't think we had herbs because back in the old days, fresh herbs were hard to come by. So I have a couple carrots. I have one big rib of celery. It's funny, I put a little thread on Facebook, a little post on Facebook saying, hey, tell me what you have in your pantry or your fridge that you need to use up, and I'll tell you what you can cook with it. And the first question, I think, was like, oh my God, what do I do with all this celery? And many other people chimed in. We're like, yes, oh my God, the celery. I suggested this very salad. And also you can poach it. So you slice it into, I kind of do it in like 1-inch chunks, and to poach it, you would put it in if you have broth or wine or both, and maybe a little butter, a little olive oil, some herbs, just enough to cover the celery and let it simmer till it's soft. And then you can strain out the celery and then let that whole liquid simmer down more and then kind of treat that as a sauce. The other thing is celery lasts a really long time in the fridge, so you shouldn't feel pressure to use it up. Ours was feeling, you know, not the crispiest, but also not the worst. So our carrots, on the other hand, are really looking terrible. They're like starting to sprout roots. They're like desperate, desperate carrots. And yeah, the bottoms are sprouting roots and the tops are going moldy. So so we're going to put them out of their misery. I've just washed them. We're cutting off the gross parts and then we're going to peel them. Often I don't peel carrots, but since these guys are looking so... Oh, I don't know how long they've been in there. Anyway, so we're going to peel them. As I'm doing this, I'm remembering that Peter hates super raw carrots. Should I accommodate his wishes and boil them just slightly? Oh, here he's coming. I don't know. I'll chop them up and see. I tend to think raw carrots are delicious and exciting. Oh, look! My lovely assistant producer is peeling them himself, probably because he can't stand to watch me do it slowly. Because I peel the carrots super slow and make sure each carrot peel lands in the trash. Whereas you can hear he's peeling as if there's a race to be won, and now he's just cleaning up all the peel all over the floor. It's two approaches. Neither one is correct. We're both right. Oh no, he says he's correct. You could talk, actually. It's fine. You don't have to do that. Alright, washing my celery. Again, yeah, it's not the greatest, so I'm cutting off a good inch on the bottom and cutting off the tops, which are looking a little withered up. Now celery, if you're feeling fancy and you have, and it's like a very big rib, you can peel a bit. I'm just going to take a chunk and see how tough our little celery strings are. They're fine. Actually, oh, celery, I didn't appreciate you before. Plain raw celery. Oh. Uh-oh. Okay, tough luck. Peter's just not gonna like this salad. And I'm gonna love it. Alright. Oh, no! I mean, the kind of cool thing about celery is it has this reputation of being, like, super blah, but if you eat just a piece of it...
It's horrible.
Oh, I got him to talk. If you eat just a piece of it...
I hate celery.
Oh, no! Okay, well, we'll just have more spaghetti. Fine. But, I mean, try tasting just a piece of it, and the flavor really, like, expands in your mouth. Anyway, the idea of a crunch salad, in my mind, is relatively... small pieces, so I'm cutting this in kind of, I have these big ribs of celery, and I sliced them in thirds lengthwise. Ooh, how exciting. The telephone, we have so many phone rings. Anyway, yes, I sliced the celery in thirds lengthwise, and then I'm just slicing across, well, not this second because I'm trimming off some gross parts, but in thirds and then cutting lengthwise in like little quarter inch chunks. So like you want each bite to have some carrot, some celery, some almond, so you can't make each piece too big. And after seeing Peter's reaction, I'm probably cutting up way too much celery. It's okay. The nice thing about a crunchy salad is it doesn't wilt under the dressing. So if we don't eat it tonight, then that's fine. I'll just stick it in the fridge, have it for lunch tomorrow. So, for some reason, I'm using my wimpy little paring knife to chop this. Because why? I'm too lazy to find the big knife. Oh, there's the big knife. Oh, and it still has a little bit of garlic on it. That's nice. All right. Oh, much better. Feel much more in charge here. Way back when Tamara Reynolds and I wrote a cookbook together, we made a little list in that cookbook of the common novice cooking mistakes. And I would say, and one of those things on that list that I definitely still stand by is not using a big enough knife. I think people who don't cook very much are scared of knives because they haven't handled them very much. And so they think they'll like ease in and start with a small knife. And if you start with too small a knife, you just get frustrated and you can't chop anything and it all seems slow. But if you just go straight for a good 10-inch chef's knife, you got a lot to work with. And it's very satisfying. I mean, a paring knife has its place, obviously. But to me, a 6-inch knife is like, why does that even exist? I'm not sure why you would use that. Unless you have teeny, tiny, tiny hands. Anyway, so I'm doing the same thing. Now I'm slicing the carrots. And these, I'm doing kind of the same thing where I'm slicing them lengthwise, a bit sloppily, admittedly, and then going in and chopping crosswise in little pieces. So what's funny about this, what I'm cooking right now is, so a standard bolognese recipe, spaghetti bolognese, is where you make you usually start with a little mix of onions, carrot, and celery, and then you add the meat and the milk, and you let that all simmer, and usually some wine, and you let that all simmer, and tomato paste. Optionally, I think, I can't really remember. I haven't looked at those kind of recipes in a long time, but minimal tomato anyway. So basically, I think we're having a deconstructed bolognese. We're not having the carrot and celery in the sauce. We're setting it aside for salad. Usually a bolognese takes, you know, a couple hours to cook, because you want that liquid simmering down very slowly and everything tenderizing and blah, 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 blah. But this is supposed to be a quick version. So all the tenderizing is happening like in the meat sitting in the milk before we even cook. And we're not even letting our vegetables get tender. We're leaving them crunchy and raw. Oh, I guess I'm not going to parboil the carrots after all. Peter is just going to hate the salad, and that's all there is to it. All right, I just had to, that extra chopping was me chopping off extra bad parts of this poor carrot that has been pasture farm. Probably should taste it to make sure it's not gross somehow. Oh no, it's fine. It's fine. It's actually quite good. Very sweet. Okay, I now have a positive mountain of carrots. I'm not even done. But what are we going to do with a quarter of a carrot? May as well chop it up. All right. Good, good. Putting the carrots in the bowl. Done. I realize this bowl is too small. It's not going to give us room to stir everything. All right. Handily, my lovely producer has poured me a little glass of wine. So I'm just going to enjoy that. Oh, very nice. Our pasta water is boiling. I'm going to turn that down to a simmer. I said almonds. Where'd they go? Again, bad kitchen protocol. I should have checked at the beginning. But here they are. Here they are. Not to worry. So, we are going to chop up a... don't want tons of almonds, but like for the carrots and celery we have, I'm doing a biggish handful of almonds. And I just put those on my cutting board. I'm gonna chop those up and then we're just gonna toast them in a pan a little bit just to bring out their flavor. And I'm being not super obsessive about how these almonds are chopped, but I'm going a little slowly because I don't want to have to like backtrack. So I'm kind of keeping an eye on the almonds and making sure I'm getting all of them and, you know, hitting them all kind of evenly as I bring the knife down. You want them chopped in coarse pieces. Not fine, like maybe a single almond in three or four pieces. So I'm not saying slice, chop each almond individually, that would be crazy. But just sort of for general size you should be going for. And obviously there's going to be a lot more smaller pieces, but hopefully not too many bigger pieces that have escaped the knife. Again, you want everything in this salad to be kind of the same size so you can have a balanced bite. Okay, that'll do. That'll do. Putting that in a little bowl. Just testing. And to toast nuts on the stove, I try to use we have one pan that's like a heavy aluminum saucepan that I usually use for toasting so I can see things turn color, because if you do it in a black skillet, we have a lot of cast iron skillets, and if you do it in a black one, it's harder to see when things are turning color. Now, this is where I usually get screwed, but I have put them on the burner and I'm walking away because I want to chop up some herbs real quick. The dill I brought out. I already washed it. You should wash it. I usually try to wash my herbs, wash the whole bunch of herbs when I get them, and then just wrap them up in a paper towel. The part I'm not using for any given dish. I'm going to wrap them up and then they're in a paper towel inside your plastic bag, and they keep pretty well that way. And then the next time you have to use it, you don't have to wash more. So I just topped off like a medium handful of dill leaves there. And again, if you don't have herbs, that's fine. If I were using the cilantro, I would probably put some cumin in the dressing. That would be nice. As is, I'm just going to make my standard dressing here. You could use a little parsley if you have it. I wonder if you could use tarragon. That's kind of intense, but it might be neat. It might be fancy and neat. Okay, so my dill is chopped up. And I'm back here at the stove. And I'm shaking the almonds around. The thing with toasting things like this. It's like, it seems like nothing is happening, I'm so boring. And then once the skillet is really heated up, then things move fast. And the trick is maintaining your patience and not turning away just at the moment where things start to get super brown. The one case for like being very careful when you cut your almonds and not having little random tiny bits is, of course, the tiny bits get browned first before everything else. And potentially burnt, which is not great. So that's why you want to kind of keep things moving around in the pan. I'm not using a spoon, I'm just sort of shaking the pan around. Ah. I'm not one of those like super flourishy flip everything in the saute pan, but if you are one of those people, this is a great time to do it. You just want little brown spots on the almonds. We got smoke coming off. Oh, that means I should turn on the vent. It's gonna be loud. All right. Okay. Our almonds are good. Sorry about the noise. I just poured them on top of the carrots and celery and the dill. In hindsight, maybe it wasn't great to pour the hot almonds on top of the dill, but whatever, they're fine. They'll manage. All right, I'm gonna put the bag of carrots and the bag of celery away. Oh, and the dill. And then we're gonna make a tiny bit of salad dressing, and then we'll cook, and then we'll be ready to eat. We're probably like 10, 12 minutes out. Oh, actually, what am I saying? We're 15 minutes out, because talking while I make salad dressing is a whole other thing. I know I talked about this in the first and only season of Cooking in Real Time. If you dig back on the website, you know, when I write this episode up on the website, I will just link back to the old salad dressing thing. But making your own vinaigrette is one of those life skills that I highly recommend, and it's something I know how to do because when I was growing up, we had salad for dinner every single night, and we constantly had our own salad dressing. And all it is garlic, oil and vinegar, and a little bit of mustard and salt and pepper. So I have that last stray clove of garlic, and I am squeezing that into a jar. A jar with a tight-fitting lid is the thing that will make your whole salad dressing life so much easier. All those recipes where they're like, and then whisk until emulsified, like, oh my god, what? No. No, just put everything in the jar and shake it. So, we're squeezing a clove of garlic in, and where'd my salt go? Where's my salt? Oh, my friends. Oh, turning off the fan. My god. Okay. So, a big pinch of salt. Probably like physically the same amount of salt as the clove of garlic. And then a little dab of mustard. I would say like, I don't know, half a teaspoon. You can, if you really like mustard, you can go heavy on the mustard. Depends. Again, this is all super flexible. Some pepper. Great, a lot of pepper. Obviously, you can adjust. My dad, who was basically the one when I was growing up who was in charge of making the salad dressing all the time. He still makes salad dressing and eats salad every night. And he has probably for like 15, 20 years been putting cumin in his dressing no matter what. I just suggested putting it in this salad, but he puts a tiny pinch in his dressing as a default. And true, every time I go to visit him and have his salad dressing, it's delicious. So up to you. I think cumin is a little bit, I don't know, bossy, can take over and really be like, hi, I'm a cumin dish. So it really depends on your taste, but I love visiting him and having his cumin dressing. I don't know if I would have it all the time, but I'm putting in, that last sound was the vinegar, and just put in a little more olive oil. I'm actually making fresh dressing on top of my old dressing in the same jar, so I can't narrate exactly the proportions, but I would say, if you read like old school vinaigrette recipes, they always say one part vinegar to three parts olive oil, which seems crazy to me. I would say, to my taste, it's between one part vinegar to two parts olive oil, and maybe even one to one, but I really like sour things. So you should do some experimenting. And do it in a really big jar so that you have room to like add more stuff to balance it out. So this is like a, you know, this is like a big salsa jar I'm using right now. Put the lid on. Shake it. In that cookbook I was talking about that I wrote with Tamara Reynolds with our novice cooking tips and things. I also talk in there about how to make salad dressing, because I've been harping on these things for years. And I say, shake it until you start feeling self-conscious about how your upper arm is jiggling, which I think I hit that point. So we're done. The nice thing is, if you start making salad dressing a lot, you can recognize, like, I can tell when I've hit the right proportions when I'm shaking it because of the sound it makes. Like, you get aware of the viscosity of the dressing. And you're like, oh, nailed it. You taste it. You're like, yep, nailed it. Whew, that's a little vinegary. And as I was shaking it, I was thinking it sounded a little thin. So I'm drizzling in a little more olive oil. So again, it's to your taste, and of course it'll depend on the kind of olive oil you have and the kind of vinegar you have. I just use red wine vinegar. We get a nice basic Greek supermarket brand red wine vinegar called Top, and it's great, super reliable, really good. If I use balsamic vinegar, I do not use all balsamic vinegar because I think it makes things way too sweet. I just don't like a sweet dressing, but you might. So that's up to you. If I do use a balsamic, it's probably like half balsamic and half red wine vinegar. Sherry vinegar dressing is delicious. I can almost never find a good sherry vinegar that doesn't cost an arm and a leg, though. Okay, that's better. That's better. Another thing that might happen is like, you're like, oh, this doesn't taste right. It tastes too oily. And you add more vinegar. You're like, ooh, tastes too sharp. Add a little more oil and it still tastes too oily. If it's still tasting too oily, but it seems like you can't add more vinegar, adding like a tiny splash of water can help. It just depends on the oil you have and the vinegar you have, and maybe even a little bit what your garlic is like at the time. Sometimes a tiny splash of water is all it takes to kind of take the sharpness off. So, all right, we got that. I'm going to pour this dressing straight over the salad right now. So things are kind of soaking in the dressing for the next 10 minutes or so while we finish the meat sauce. All right. Okay, so we are at the stove. And turn. No, off. All right. Don't want our hood on right now because you wouldn't be able to hear a thing I say. I'm going to use my shallow stainless steel saucepan for this. You could use cast iron. I'm not using cast iron because I'm using tomato paste, and tomato and cast iron are not great friends because of the acid in the tomato, and the acid in the milk is a little much. So I'm sticking with stainless steel, but if cast iron is all you have, it's probably fine. I don't think the acid in this stuff is enough to like cause a, and we're not cooking it for long, so it's not enough to cause like a bad flavor reaction, but it is enough that it's probably not great for the finish on your cast iron. I'm gonna get out some pasta. Now, since I was too clever to save the instruction for this, I can't really remember. It's probably been like 6 years at least since I cooked this stuff. So I can't really remember how long it takes for everything to simmer down. So I'm actually going to start the cooking and we'll see how it's going, and then I'll put the pasta in because I don't want the pasta to be done and we're sitting around impatiently waiting for the meat sauce to finish. All right. So I'm putting a big, very generous glug of olive oil in the saucepan here. Enough to cover the bottom of the pan very generously. And I have that up on about medium high. So what we're gonna do first is put in the garlic, and I'm violating one of the simplest rules of cooking right now. Usually you want the oil to be hot when you put things in. If the oil is hot, things are less likely to stick, so on and so forth. For garlic, it probably doesn't make too much difference, but I'm just feeling impatient. So, and you can hear, it's already starting to sizzle a little bit. So we want to just get the garlic covered in the oil, because the garlic is going to cook pretty quickly. What we really need to have happen is for our nice little anchovies, I'm tipping them in now, we need our anchovies to start dissolving. Remember how I said we didn't need to chop them up? That's because they just melt nicely. So I'm turning the heat down now to like medium low, because I don't want the garlic to burn, but I want the anchovies to start squishing. So I'm just going to leave that. I'm going to get a spoon for the tomato paste. And one other nice ingredient for this, like very particular ingredient, especially if you're doing beef, is whole nutmeg. So I'm getting those out, and I'm getting the grater. This is just to like keep myself busy thinking ahead while I'm waiting for those anchovies to do their thing. Was I thinking, oh, I was gonna get off the Parmesan cheese also. Where'd you go? Okay, so the stuff we need for finishing it is all there and ready. All right, now we're back at the stove, and I'm gonna, that's the stuff. Now the anchovies, you just sort of nudge them with the back of your spoon and they just dissolve away to nothing. They just crumble up into little smooshy bits. Oh, I love them so. If you don't like anchovies, I would say, like, what anchovies are doing is adding that, the mythical umami flavoring. You know, 22 years ago when I clipped this out of the Southwest Airlines magazine, I didn't know about umami. But, of course, we knew that anchovies were good. So, you can always sub in other things. And also the tomato paste is a good umami delivery. So, like, if you have dried mushrooms and you don't have anchovies, dried mushrooms are a good sub. You would put them in boiling water, like just to sit in boiling water, pour boiling water over them, cover them up, let them sit for 15-20 minutes, and then pull them up out and chop them into really small pieces and save. I usually save the liquid that you soaked them in, and you can pour some of that into the sauce as well. And that's good in a regular, more tomato-y meat sauce as well. Just adds some more depth. And that's what happened to the first half of the pound of ground beef I had actually earlier in the week. Was I made that like more standard beef tomato sauce. Okay, our anchovies are all squished up, and our garlic is all nice and golden brown. And I'm going to add some tomato paste. I guess I should look at the recipe. It says 2 tablespoons of tomato paste for a single serving. So that would be 4 tablespoons. I'm a little skeptical. I'm going to hedge my bets a little bit. And I'm also not using a real tablespoon measure, so I'm probably being more generous than an actual tablespoon. I put in like 3 heaping spoonfuls and a little dab of extra. So we've still got the heat on medium low, and we're just kind of stirring this all around to like make it a semi-cohesive thing. And we want the raw, just a little bit. I'm going to turn it up to medium, actually. Just want the raw edge taken off the tomato paste. So the thing about doubling recipes or tripling recipes or whatever, I have found you don't want to do necessarily double the fat in a recipe, especially if it's like, you know, add a tablespoon of olive oil in the pan before you cook the garlic. Like, you don't necessarily have to double that strictly. It might end up making the whole thing too greasy. And the other thing to keep in mind when you're doubling recipes is things will take longer to cook and things will take longer to prep. So you don't have to strictly double the amount of time, but you do have to factor in a little bit extra time when you're making a larger quantity of things. All right, so this is nice. You can kind of see the oil simmering through the tomato paste. It is looking not very good. And now we're going to add the milk and meat, that weird rug padding pink stuff that's been sitting there. But it's gonna taste great eventually. I'm gonna bring the salt back. Where did our pepper go? Probably don't need much salt in this because the anchovies are super salty. We will put in some pepper. Although that's funny. Oh, you know, it doesn't actually call for pepper. I just did that out of habit. Anyway, can't be bad. And I'm gonna put a little pinch of salt. But again, like I said, less than I normally would because of the anchovies. Alright, so fortunately, by stirring up the milk, meat, combination with the tomato paste, things are starting to look a little bit more appetizing. I'm turning the heat up to medium high just to sort of get things moving again, because adding that huge amount of cold stuff really killed the action here in the skillet. All right. So, yeah, and this is about when I wish I had saved the actual written instructions for this recipe, because I think I put things in the right order. So that's the thing about recipes. Probably most people know this by now, but maybe I'm saying it just in case. A good recipe, like recipe writing convention, says that the list of ingredients is done in the order you use them in the recipe. So I can look at the list of this list of ingredients and kind of guess how everything was put together, because it's beef, milk, and I remember those being soaked together, then olive oil, then garlic, and to me that says, oh, you put the olive oil in the pan and then you put the garlic in and an anchovy, and then you add, and then it says 2 tablespoons tomato paste. So I'm assuming you add that to the garlic and anchovy, and then salt, and then it says spaghetti. So you can kind of deduce, it's a pretty simple ingredients list too, which helps. So you can kind of deduce how things are. So what I can't remember though is whether you let this cook covered for a little while, or if we just stir and simmer. In any case, it's moving along, I think, pretty quickly. So I'm going to go ahead and put in the pasta to boil. And then, because looking at it now, like, I don't think it's going to need too much longer to cook. 10, 12 minutes to cook, maybe. We may as well have the pasta going. This is just straight normal spaghetti. You could, of course, use any long, skinny, whatever, fettuccine, linguine. I'm just looking at this. Oh, this is 10 to 12 minutes. This is Greek spaghetti. My producer, Peter, is a fan of Greek Melissa brand pasta, and we can get it very easily. We've been shopping a lot at the Greek store because it's less crowded than our regular all-purpose grocery store. So we have so much Greek pasta. Anyway, spaghetti number 6. It's the standard size. All right, pasta is in, and I never used to do this, but I'm putting on the timer. What? I'm too fancy to use the timer? I'm too good to use the timer? No, it's very helpful. So, 10 minutes of pasta, 10 minutes of sauce simmering. I'm stirring the sauce now, and I'm just kind of mashing out the lumps with the back of my spoon. The goal of it is to have it very thin and velvety, and you can, I mean, when you're doing this yourself, you will see the texture is very different from just adding straight ground beef to a pan. So that is the magic done by the milk. It's really broken down a lot of the little fibers, connective tissue, da 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 da. So we have almost like powdery mixture. Peter, help us pass the time. 10 minutes. Hey, stop drinking my wine. Oh, what'd you do with it? It's not fair. This always happens. My unguarded wine glass. Jeez, thanks. Okay, I, as usual, pass the time by drinking my wine and by cleaning up. Cheers, my dear. Thanks. Okay, we have 8 minutes and 30 seconds. I think I'm going to put... Well, let's... I'm going to try stirring the salad. I feel like it should be in a bigger bowl just so I can mix everything up better. It's really jammed into this bowl. Oh, my producer is... What's my producer doing? Fussing. It's fine. Oh, geez, it's fine. Overboiling. That only matters if it's like up over the top of the pot. Overboiling. That is not a word. Wasting fuel. Okay, I laugh now, but fast forward 3 weeks. Anyway, no, we'll be fine. We will be absolutely fine. All right, pasta is... I'm turning the pasta water back up. It should be boiling. Jeez. All right, the sauce is simmering. I have that down just about on the lowest setting. I've taken the wooden spoon out of the pan and set it aside. Ages and ages ago, when was this? 1996, 97? I think it was in 1997. My boyfriend at the time, his brother-in-law went to cooking school and wrote a little detailed newsletter about it. And this is, I love how we've come full circle. Like, newsletters are the new hot thing. Oh, honey, we were doing email newsletters back when email was invented. So, David Mudd would send out a hilarious and very well-written newsletter about his experience in cooking school. And it was a great combination of all the strange people who are in his class, good people, bad people, funny cooks, you know, like funny teachers and all their little foibles. So it was like character studies, as I remember it, as well as practical cooking tips and even occasional recipes. It was really informative, and it was like, I'm never going to be organized enough to go to cooking school, but here this guy has done it, and I'm totally impressed, and I get to learn from him. And one of the things I remember from that newsletter was very early on, he got yelled at by one of the cooks for leaving his wooden spoon in a sauce. And the teacher was like, you don't leave the wooden spoon in the sauce because your sauce is going to taste like wood. Like, actual, you know, volatile oils are still in that wood, or whatever else you cooked with that spoon is still in that wood. And you don't want it affecting taste of your sauce. So every time I take my wooden spoon out of the sauce, I think of David Mudd and his excellent newsletter from 1997, which I learned so much. I'm putting a little more salad dressing on because I've now stirred the salad and it's whatever. Overdress it. Nothing wrong with overdressing. another bit of family wisdom along with eating salad every night was my mother saying, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, which I think definitely is the case with salad dressing, especially if you've gone to the trouble of making it yourself. Okay. Crunch salad, man. Very crunchy. I don't know if you can hear me crunching it. It's incredibly loud in my head. Anyway, that's really nice. So, like I said last week, it's good to have variety of textures. And so now we have super crunchy that's going to be going nicely offsetting this sort of smoothy, silky pasta sauce. And also sort of the bright, vinegar is going to be nice because the meat is a very, like, base note. The sauce is looking great. So it's kind of separating out some of the extra liquid from the milk has cooked off. And now we've got these like lovely pools of olive oil, orangey olive oil. You know, the best grease is orange grease. When you have orange grease, you know you've cooked something very good. So I see the orange grease developing. It's a good sign. And I'm just tidying up some more and more. And going back to my wine glass. I wrote a whole cookbook that had a million jokes about drinking so much wine. And to be honest, I look back on that and I'm like, whoa, how did I do that, man? I can barely concentrate enough when I'm sober to cook. So if I start drinking while I cook, it is really not a productive session. But let's have a little taste. I'm just, the one thing, everything else, I will not put you through having to listen while I wash the dishes. But the only thing I am washing are the knives. We have a very strict knife protocol in this house. No knives in the sink for safety's sake. And as soon as you use, you should always just like wash the knives straight up and put them back on the knife rack. No letting them sit around on the cutting board. So that was my one thing. I was super cleaning. And I'm gonna give the sauce another little stir. Great. Looking very nice. Yeah. There's still a little extra liquid. We want really minimal liquid. It's basically all that liquid is sort of ambient stuff from the meat and a little bit of milk. And we don't need it. We want it just to be sort of meat and tomato and anchovy garlic emulsion kind of thing. And I should get out some bowls for our pasta. We're at 1 minute. Not bad. So I'm going to take a little mug and scoop out some pasta water and pour some pasta water in each bowl, just a little bit, like an inch deep, just enough to warm up the bowl. Because it's been weirdly cold. So part of the reason I was sleepy earlier was because I was like, I just had to wrap myself up in my bathrobe because it was so cold. Now that I'm all wrapped up in my bathrobe, I feel like I should be taking a nap. Okay. I'm going to need here another fork, I guess, to scoop out the pasta. Oh, we need the pasta strainer. That would help. And we need other things that are just falling off the shelves, volunteering themselves. Let's see how the pasta is. Ouchie, ouch. Oh yeah. That's done. It's salty. I should say about salt, like, that's obviously a very personal thing, and I think I happen to have a very high salt tolerance just because I salt my food, and then I'm used to it, and then I want more salt, and up. As I said last time, it's really difficult to eat too much salt in your own home with food you have cooked yourself. So in that respect, you don't need to worry about over-salting for health reasons, but you do for taste reasons. Like, if you don't have a high salt threshold, I'm tossing the hot water out of the bowls. If you don't have a high salt threshold, like when I go home and cook and my brother's there, he's like, oh my God, what have you done? This is like barely tolerable. So But he's like out foraging nuts and berries all the time, so I guess he doesn't have a lot of natural sources of salt. Anyway, so yeah, he has a very different palate. And you might too. You might too. So you can always add more salt. It's difficult to take it away. I just tipped all the pasta out. So we are good to go. Putting a little in each. Whoa, putting way too much in each bowl. I like putting things in big bowls just because there's like, oh, room. But then it's very easy to overfill. So I think I just put way too much pasta in that bowl. I boiled about half a pound of spaghetti, which is, in my mind, too much for two people. I think, to me, a pound of spaghetti usually serves, or, oh, that's the other thing. Since it's Greek, it's 500 grams, so it's 1.1 pound, so it's a little bit more. So that usually serves five or six people. Anyway, starting conservative because we had some snacks earlier and I'm not starving. And I'm turning the heat off on the sauce here. And it's very, like, there's beautiful, it looks like the surface of Mars. It's beautiful there, like little. It's all red. It's gorgeous, gorgeous. And I'm opening up our Parmesan cheese. Remember how I said I got the stuff together to finish everything, which is nutmeg and Parmesan cheese. So we're gonna spoon the sauce onto the pasta and then add the add the nutmeg and the cheese. You can, of course, add the nutmeg to the sauce. But if you have leftovers, you're probably going to want to freshly nutmeg the next time you eat it. You can, it's very funny, the recipe actually is like, don't use pre-ground nutmeg. If you only have pre-ground nutmeg, just use pre-ground nutmeg. It's fine. It's not going to taste exactly the same, but it's not going to taste terrible either. Just be conservative with it. Alright. Here, we have this like super like velvety fine tomato sauce. Thank you, chef of 22 years ago or whatever. And here we go with the nutmeg. I have a microplane grater. You don't need like the microplane grater for nutmeg and the microplane grater for cheese and the microplane grater for zest. They're all basically the same. You just need one. So that's what I'm doing. I have one tiny little nub of nutmeg that I'm grating against a very large, wide microplane grater. It's okay. It's doing the trick. I will tell you, I love nutmeg. Maybe this is why I am drawn to this dish. I find that anything that calls for cinnamon, if you just put nutmeg instead, it tastes so much better and much more interesting. Mark my words, I'm using another little nutmeg nub because just smelling it makes me want more. Maybe that was too much. And we're going to grate some cheese over with the same grater. Nice, fluffy Parmesan cheese. Oh, one thing, I didn't do it, but one thing you could do is actually set aside some of the pasta water, more than what I poured in the bowls to keep them warm. You can set aside a little bit of that, like, in the mug, and then if things kind of seize up or the sauce gets too dry, you can add a little pasta water and stir everything around. That's why, as I was saying at the very beginning, having starchy pasta water is actually useful, and it serves a purpose. Ah, this looks great. Okay, we're done. We're done here. So I'm going to turn this off, and I'm going to go eat. Thank you so much for listening. Please enjoy. I hope this has passed the time in a quality way. It's funny, I'm like, oh, an hour and 25 minutes of just me talking is very... You can cook this much faster than we just did right now. Trust me. Yeah, the cooking in real time has slowed down immensely for these quarantine times. Anyway, as I said at the beginning, you can go to the website, cookinginrealtime.com, and the whole... The recipes are up there, and the shopping, not shopping list is up there, along with a little discussion of stuff you can sub in. This is not the, like, wild and crazy substitute anything you have kind of recipe I did in the last episode, but I'm sure it has a lot fewer ingredients, so I'm sure there are ways you can make it work. And probably between now and when I write stuff up later, maybe I'll think of more ways, and they'll be on the website. And, as ever, if you like it, let me know. If you don't like it, let me know. If you have suggestions or if you're curious about something and you want to know more, email me, or I did turn on comments on the website, so you can leave comments, or you can track me down on Twitter or whatever. I am easy to find. And what else? I think maybe next time I might make a quiche. Is that crazy? Are we all running out of butter or milk and eggs? I hope not. 'Cause learning how to make a good pie crust, if you haven't, it's a really good thing to know. And once you can do that, man, a quiche, it's like an easy thing instead of this weird, complicated thing. And it's a great way to use up all the weird things in your fridge. So, don't hold me to it, but that's maybe a preview of coming attractions. But if you have a better idea, just drop me a note. Anyway, till next time, enjoy your cooking. Thanks for listening. Take care. Bye.